Turn to our text then, 2 Samuel chapter 6. As we finish up this chapter, David has been moving his capital to the city of Jerusalem. It's been a little bit of a process because when he first started to move the capital there, he was attacked by the Philistines, not once but twice. And kind of reminds me of those infomercials. Commercials, you know, you always see stuff that's sold only on TV. They never give you just one of them. They always, but wait, there's more. For this low price, you can have not one, but two. So, David, for the low price of becoming king of Israel, you can have not one, but two invasions of the Philistines for only one easy payment of 1995. And so he had two invasions that he had to fend off in the end of chapter 5. Which he did successfully by obeying the Lord's rather odd instructions about going around behind the army, waiting for the sound of the Lord's army marching in the treetops, and then going out to attack. That he did. That really helped secure his position as the king of Israel, because now the Philistines are his biggest enemy. They're right next door to him. They're only a few miles away, 15, 17 miles from Jerusalem to the Philistine border. And so they're very close by, and they also hate Israel. So these are his biggest enemy. This, though it probably seemed like a big interruption to David's plan to move his capital, it really was something that God used to help establish David as the king. Because now he can see to the business of establishing his kingdom without having to worry about the Philistines, because they've just been slaughtered. Their armies have been beaten back, and it's going to take them some time to regroup. He will have other battles with them, but for now they've been pushed aside, and David is able to focus on what he wants to do in establishing Jerusalem. To really make Jerusalem the center of Israel, not just politically, but religiously, David is moving the tabernacle to Jerusalem. He's setting it up on the hill of Zion, and he wants to make Jerusalem not only the center of his kingdom politically, but also the center religiously. Because in the law, it was required of all the men in Israel to assemble around the tabernacle three times a year for three feasts. That was bringing all the men of the country together to David at the tabernacle at Jerusalem at least three times a year. It was a huge unifying experience for the people of Israel. And so David wants that to be in Jerusalem, not somewhere else. Up until this point, the tabernacle has wandered all over the place. We have seen it. We have seen it in Gilgal. We've seen it in Shiloh. We've seen it in Gibeon. We have seen it all over the place. And so he wants this ark to come to its resting place, a final home for the Lord to dwell in. But he also wants the tabernacle in Jerusalem to be symbolically the throne from which God rules his people. David really wants this kingdom to be God's kingdom, not his own. Isn't that a contrast from the previous king? Saul was all about establishing his own authority over the kingdom. David wants God to be the ruler. He wants Jehovah to be enthroned on the praises of Israel. And so he brings the ark up to Jerusalem. Well, he had some trouble with that, as we looked at the last couple of weeks. The first time he tried to move it, he didn't do so according to God's law. He put it on a cart rather than having the Levites carry it. And how'd that turn out for him? Not too good. It almost fell off, and a man died for touching the ark. Uzzah was struck down by the wrath of God for reaching out to touch the ark, because David didn't follow God's prescribed plan for moving it. Now, it might have seemed like it was a more secure way of doing it, but as is often the case, we've got to stop relying on our own understanding of what is secure and do things the way God tells us to. Because the most secure way to accomplish anything is going to be the way God told us to do it. We, especially if we are influenced heavily by the world around us. Does anybody know what you call? I know you guys are good students of Answers in Genesis, and they talk about this a lot. What is the worldview that dominates our society? It is called secular humanism, and it is ruled by a concept called naturalism. Okay? There's a couple of fun words you can use to impress everybody around the water cooler this week. Secular humanism basically means secular. It's apart from the church. It has nothing to do with religion, and so society generally is operating with a non-God view of the world. God doesn't have anything to do with life, so it's secular. Humanism means that we look at ourselves as basically the center of our world. We are really caught up with what humans can do. We write articles about how amazing it is that we can build robots and all the stuff that they can accomplish with them, and computers and technology, and we really just are enamored with our own ability to accomplish things. So it is secular humanism. It is focus upon humans apart from any concept of God. That is ruled by a view of the world also called naturalism. Naturalism says that there's no such thing as the supernatural. Naturalism means everything has to be able to be explained through natural process. Hence, evolution is the rule of the day, because that's how you explain the world without God. That's how you, well, that's so they say. You know, we can poke holes in that theory all day long if we want to, but that's how they say we explain the world without a creator. And so, naturalism. If anything happens, it has to have a natural, and sometimes you'll hear this word, logical explanation. What did you say this morning in Sunday school, Dan? Say, the logical explanation is, it was a miracle. I mean, that's a logical explanation. Okay? What's your logical explanation for creation? God did it. It happened. God did it. I think this morning we were talking about the multiplying of the fishes and the loaves, right? So what's your logical explanation? Well, everybody must have been hiding their fishes in their jackets, and when Jesus convinced that little boy to be giving and sharing, that convinced everybody else, and they were so sharing and so giving, it was enough for everybody to eat. That's a naturalistic explanation. Unfortunately, it doesn't fit with the biblical text. Eldon. That is a lot of hot dogs. But that's true. That would have been a lot of food. See how much they were tucking away in their tunics and hiding from everybody? I mean, that's just selfishness. Boy. So that's a naturalistic explanation. If you ever watch the History Channel, does anybody like History Channel? Okay, I like History Channel. Eldon, what are you going to say? $500 barbecue grills and 2 semi-trucks to feed those people. Well, you know, I don't know. Maybe they had 500 barbecue grills. It's, who knows? If you ever watch the History Channel, though, anytime they do a study on biblical history, it will be completely wrapped up with naturalism. So if they do something on the plagues of Egypt, guess what caused the water to turn red? Algae. Yeah, algae grew in there and it was red. And it, I mean, we have pictures of this. It makes the sea look red. It actually happens. And, well, you know, the darkening of the sky while a volcano erupted not far away and sent so much ash and soot that it blocked out the sun. And so you'll get explanations like that. Problem is, again, these people don't read their Bibles. They don't actually look at what the Bible says when they do these programs, because it clearly says it didn't turn red like blood, it turned to blood. And tell me, an Egyptian soldier doesn't know the difference between blood and red water. I'll bet he does. He's spilt a lot of it. He knows what blood looks like. So, these naturalistic explanations people try to come up with things, they do affect us. And sometimes we bring that into our Christian life and we want to apply a naturalistic explanation to things rather than doing it the way God told us to. And that's what David learned by bringing that ark. He had an idea, probably got it from the Philistines when they sent the ark back on a new cart. So he tries the same thing, but it didn't work. Because God made sure that it didn't work. And rather than having a naturalism view of the world, we've really got to have a sovereign God view of the world that says God is in control of all the events of my life from morning until morning, so that He is able to make things happen. So if He tells me to do it a certain way, He will ensure that that way is the way that's going to work. Or at least it's going to be the way that's best for me. So, march around the city 7 days? Bad idea. Doesn't sound like a good military strategy. But God's in control and He told you to do it that way. Spend how much of your time in church? Well, He doesn't give us a command on time, does He? Take 1 day and seven to rest? Oh, that's not a good idea. You'll never get anything done. Yeah, but God told us to do that. Give how much of your money to the Lord as an offering? That sounds crazy. Then I won't be financially stable. I won't be able to take care of my own needs. Oh, yes, you will. Trust me. God is able to multiply the fishes to make sure, as long as you do it His way. Now, don't let me convince you into thinking that if you do it His way, it'll always be easiest, because often God calls us to do it the hard way. And trusting Him is almost never the easy way. So, don't think that God is going to make things easy when we do it His way. Sometimes it will be hard. So that's what David learned. So the second time he brought the ark back to Jerusalem, he did it the way God told him to in the law. The priests carried the ark on their shoulders, and they went the whole distance without one of them ever tripping. Why is that? Because they're sure-footed, right? Those men practiced? Because David went ahead of them and cleared all the big stones out of the way. No. Because God is able to ensure that things work the way He says they're going to work. Okay? And so he got the ark to Jerusalem. So let's pick up with verse 12, just to review a couple of things. It was told King David, "The Lord has blessed the household of Obed-Edom and all that belongs to him because of the ark of God." So David went and brought up the ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with rejoicing. We don't know how far that is. We're not really sure where some of these places are, so we don't know how far it had to be transported. All right, so it could have been a long distance, it could have been a fairly short distance. But at any rate, David is going to bring this ark up to the city of David with rejoicing. This is an exciting time. Verse 13, "When those who bore the ark of the Lord had gone 6 steps, he sacrificed an ox and a fattened animal." This is, again, prescribed in God's prescription for worship in the law, or the sacrifices and the proper way to move this ark. So he has people carrying the ark. He's performing the correct sacrifices. Verse 14, "And David danced before the Lord with all his might, and David was wearing a linen ephod. So David and all the house of Israel brought up the ark of the Lord with shouting and with the sound of the horn." So again, this is an exciting time. The music is very lively. David's leading this procession that includes all of the people of Israel that he's got gathered together, and all the music that's going before the ark, and all the sacrifices that are going on. And you have to imagine this scene here. The priests take 6 steps, and what do? They sacrifice an animal right there on the road, so that as the priests walk, they're stepping in the blood of these sacrificed animals. Because as we have talked about, that ark represents God's holy standard. It is His law. And how many of us live up to that law? Nobody. So what do we get out of the law? We get judgment. We get condemnation. We get wrath. We don't sing too many songs about that in church. You know, there aren't too many hymns about the wrath of God. Probably should be, so we could appreciate it a little bit more. But the picture is, here comes the ark of God, and so that it's not coming to Jerusalem in judgment, we're going to pave the way with the blood of sacrifices, so that the priests' feet are stepping in the mud created by the mixture of these animals' blood and the dirt of the city. Because the only way you can atone for sin is through blood. One life given in place of another. And so as David is going up before there, the only reason he can join in the celebration, knowing that God is coming peacefully to Jerusalem and not in judgment and wrath, is because There's blood all over the floor. And the priests are marching through it. One of the troubles that we have in contemporary Christianity is that we don't want to proclaim the wrath of God. We don't preach the whole gospel. We want to talk about the love of God, which is a great thing. The love of God is shed abroad into our hearts, but upon whom is the love of God shed? Those who believe. What about those who don't believe? What do they get? What did Jesus say to those who don't believe? Yeah, you abide under the wrath of God because you have not believed in the name of the only begotten Son. And we don't preach about wrath. Well, this is a living illustration of the appeasement of God's wrath as this ark moves up to Jerusalem, tromping through the blood. And David celebrating before it with joy because God's wrath has not been exercised against him, it's been exercised against the substitute. In that case, the symbolic substitute were those animals, and that blood was strewn all over the ground. Who is our substitute? Jesus. Why is the last Sunday in March this year such an important day? Because we celebrate the substitute. Jesus died for my sins. He bore the wrath that I deserved. So that if I march in triumphal procession to the temple to worship God, I'm going to be tromping through the blood of Christ that was poured out at Calvary. So there's David dancing and singing before the Lord in worship. And boy, there's some people that like to bend this all out of shape and say, David danced, right? So we should dance. Now, we got to make some distinctions here. What was David doing? Praising the Lord. So, yes, he was dancing. Is dancing an appropriate form of worship? Sometimes it is. Sometimes it is, okay? But are there types of dancing that are not appropriate? I highly doubt that David was doing anything like Miley Cyrus sort of dancing. And this big thing that she's come up with called twerking. Okay. There's a difference between twirling and raising your hands in the air and jumping up and down. And this is what David's doing. He's spinning in circles. He's jumping up and down, lifting his hands in praise. He's singing loudly. There's a huge difference between that and some of the dancing that goes on today. So make distinctions there in what is appropriate for worship and what's not. Don't let people just quote a quick verse to you and convince you that anything goes as far as worship goes. Sometimes you hear about repetition. You say, oh, the Psalms are repetitious. You say, well, one psalm is repetitious. Which one is that? It's 142, I think. But it mentions, because his love endures forever. They made a song out of it. But sandwiched between each of those statements and that phrase, his love endures forever, is mentioned about 20 times in that psalm. So that would seem repetitious. But guess what's sandwiched in between each of those verses? Content. There's something. Why do you say that God's love endures forever? Because he did this. His love endures forever. And he did this. His love endures forever. And he did this. His love endures forever. So we can use those examples of worship, but we've got to make good distinctions with them. When you get into talking about songs of worship, there has to be good content. It has to be teaching what's right. It has to be teaching the truth about God and who He is. So, verse 16, as the ark of the Lord came into the city of David, here's David dancing in front of it and shouting and twirling in front of the ark, Michal, the daughter of Saul, wait a second, let's pause for a minute. Why do you think it's calling her the daughter of Saul? Who is Michal? David's wife. Now, I don't know how many of you did this with your kids. You know, and maybe when Matt was misbehaving, did you ever look at Gary and say, your son? Yeah. When he's doing something good, you say, oh, that's my boy, right? But if he's misbehaving, you say, Gary, your son. Okay. Here's sort of what the Lord is doing here, because Michal is going to display some character that is, let's just say, less than godly, less than desirable. She is displaying the character of her father, Saul. And we'll see why that is as we go here. But the Lord points that out. She is acting just like her dad. Michal, the daughter of Saul, looked out the window and saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, and she was ecstatic and excited to know that God had been enthroned in Jerusalem. No, you're shaking your heads at me. Why? She despised him in her heart. Okay, I won't take a poll on how many ladies have looked out the window and seen their husbands working or something and despised him in their hearts, right? Hopefully that hasn't happened. But here she is, she looks out the window, she sees him leading this procession, and she's angry at it, and she's embittered about it. And we'll find out why here in just a moment. That's going to get to that. But they brought, verse 17, they brought in the ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent that David had pitched for it. Remember, David didn't build the temple. He pitched the tent. He brought the tabernacle to Jerusalem. He wanted the ark to have a permanent resting place, but there's no temple yet. It is still the cloth tabernacle that God had Moses build several hundred years before. But now it's got a spot, and that's where it's going to stay for quite a long time until Solomon builds the temple and brings the ark into the temple. David offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. So here is this just this massive worship service going on. We're going to find out here in the next verse that the entire nation has been gathered together for this. It's not a private ceremony. So you've got thousands upon thousands of Israelites gathered together to see Jehovah enthroned in Jerusalem in his tabernacle. And they offer the sacrifices that were prerequisite to sanctifying the place, so that the ark could rest there in peace. So when David had finished offering the burnt offerings and the peace offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord of hosts. Here is David acting as the mediator of God's covenant blessing, which he is. As the king of Israel, he's the one that is supposed to dispense kingdom blessings. We've talked about this a little bit on Sunday mornings as Jesus sends out the 12. Tells them to heal the lepers, raise the dead, cure the sick, all of those miracles that they were supposed to perform. Those were the Lord Jesus using those disciples as dispensers of kingdom blessing. Well, here, David is the one dispensing kingdom blessing. And so he blesses the people. Well, how does he do that? He's doing it in the name of the Lord of hosts, verse 19, distributing among all the people, the whole multitude of Israel, both men and women, a cake of bread, a portion of meat, and a cake of raisins to each one. How's that for an impenetrable wall of separation between the church and the state? You have David funding a worship service at the tabernacle. And this meal that he's giving them, he's providing everybody in the country enough food to have a celebratory meal around the enthroning of Jehovah. I mean, that must have been pretty expensive, especially given the victuals that he's passing out here. The whole multitude, both men and women, so each one, they got a cake of bread, and we're not talking a little wonder loaf here. The cake of bread that they would make, they didn't bake their bread in nice, like, long, lumpy loaves the way we do. They would throw the lump on and cook it, and so it baked up and kind of looked like a rock. And so it was circular, and it would puff up really big like this, but it was a round loaf of bread, and it was big. So he's giving everybody in the whole nation, thousands upon thousands of people. We don't have a number of how many are here, but it's called a multitude. How long does it take to make a loaf of bread, Kimmy? A couple hours, and we usually make four at our house, four at a time. So you've got a couple hours to make four loaves of bread. How long does it take, David, to prepare enough bread for the whole nation? This is a big deal. Okay, David has spent a lot of time preparing this. Not only does he give him a whole loaf of bread, I lost my spot there, a cake of bread, a portion of meat, so they have some meat to go on their plate, and a cake of raisins. Now, I like raisins. I'm not sure how I'd feel about raisin cake. Of course, this is not talking about, you know, a soft, white, fluffy cake. This is raisins smashed into a patty. And then they would cut it up and you would take it and eat it. It was Actually, it's pretty good. That's about what happens to, what are those, what's that brand? You buy the little boxes of raisins, and when you try to get them out, they come out in the same shape of the box, and they're all clumped together, right? Because that's just what raisins do. So he gives everybody a loaf of bread, a piece of meat, and a cake of raisins for their celebratory meal for each one, to the man and to the woman. So everybody has got enough food to have this meal, and then all the people departed, each to his house. And at the house was where they would have the meal of celebration. So they would take this worship service home, and then they were supposed to, as a family, participate in a family worship event. I hope family worship is part of your schedule, by the way, where you gather everybody in the household together, spend some time in prayer, spend some time looking at the Word, sometimes singing some psalms. Whether it's before your evening meal, we usually do our family worship time at breakfast, so we'll eat breakfast together and then we'll spend some time looking in the Word and memorizing together. But family worship is an important part of just celebrating together as a family and building up each other in the faith. It's a constant throughout the Old Testament, especially when you read passages in like Deuteronomy 6, when it's talking about instructing your children and says you should instruct them in the way, when you rise up in the morning and when you're out working in the field and when you lie down again at night, constantly the family should be uniting around worship. And so that's what David is doing. He's making it very easy for these folks to go home and unite together around a family worship meal. Verse 20, David returned to bless his household. So he comes home, he's excited from the... I mean, just put yourself in this place. Here he's just led this fantastic worship procession. He's been the dispenser of God's blessing to the nation, and he gets home and he comes in and he's ready to gather his whole family together, say, let's get around the table, people. Let's celebrate the Lord Jesus. Oh, they wouldn't have known him by that name at that point. Let's celebrate Jehovah and all of his covenant goodness to us and his covenant faithfulness to us and his faithfulness to me particularly by establishing me as the king, and let's celebrate. David's probably excited here. And what's the next word? But. Here's the contrast. Boy, what a heart-wrenching contrast this is. Didn't we just talk this morning about how the radical commitment that we have to have to our God will cause divisions, even within our own family? And here we've got an illustration of it, because David is radically committed to Jehovah. Michal, on the other hand, is not. But Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David. I mean, she is not even waiting for him to come to her. She is livid about this. So she marches out the door as soon as he gets home, and she says to him, "Did you have a good worship service, dear? I hope everything went well. Did the sound system work fine? You didn't have any glitches in the AV?" Oh, no. She comes in. You have to imagine the sarcastic tone going on here, too. "How the king of Israel honored himself today, uncovering himself today before the eyes of his servants, his female servants, as one of the vulgar fellows shamelessly uncovers himself." Oh, David, you were just full of honor today, dancing like that and showing off in front of everybody. She's mad. Her speech here is just dripping with sarcasm and disdain for him. How things have changed. Why? What happened? This is the gal that protected David when Saul was trying to kill him. You remember that? She hid him. She helped him get out of the house at night. What did she put in the bed? An idol. And she put a little piece of goat's hair on top of it. Michal, why do you have an idol in your house? So even way back then, we start to get the little inclinations that Michal's heart is not totally set upon the Lord. She's worshiping idols. But David loved her, and he took her, married her anyway. How the king of Israel honored himself today. I don't think she means honored, even though she's saying honored. Uncovering himself. Here, the reference that she's talking to is that David was wearing a linen ephod, which would have been a long white robe, And as he's spinning and twirling, undoubtedly the robe is coming up and showing his lower sections. Now, he would have been wearing some undergarments as well, and we're not talking skimpy spandex or anything. It would have been something that very well covered and probably to us today would have been more than acceptable as a pair of shorts to wear out and around. So it's not like he's completely showing himself, but he's out there, he's spinning around, his legs are showing, and maybe his waist is showing as he's twirling and dancing before the Lord, and that's what she's mad about. And she's jealous here. Oh, how you uncovered himself today. Before who? Before the eyes of his servants, female servants. She's worried about all the other girls that saw David. She's jealous. I think she's probably also a little bit humiliated, which we're going to see here. But she says, as one of the vulgar fellows shamelessly uncovers himself, I think a lot of what's going on here is not only a little bit of jealousy at David uncovering himself, but also a little bit of a royal pride going on here. David, you're too good for this. We're royalty after all. We don't act like this. And so she's humiliated. She feels like David has dragged the family name down. So probably because her father Saul was such a prideful man, she's picked up on a lot of that. And she herself is a prideful woman. And she doesn't want to be humiliated in front of anybody. She wants to be treated as the royalty that she is. Where David's response is going to show just how radically committed he is to Jehovah. Verse 21, and David said to Michal, it was before the Lord who chose me above your father and above all his house to appoint me as a prince over Israel, the people of the Lord. Ouch. So what's he reminding her of? Your dad got kicked out. So if you're hanging on to any sense of pride about your family heritage or about your position in Israel as a princess of Israel, just remember, you got kicked out. And I was worshiping before the Lord. Doesn't he deserve it? Do we ever hold back our worship because we're afraid of what people think? Do you ever hold back from singing because you're afraid that somebody might hear you and maybe you're not as confident about your voice as you should be? I like to tell people everyone can sing, they just don't know it. Not everybody likes to sing, and I get that. Not everybody is gifted with a voice that you would put on radio. You know, some people, they say they have a great face for radio. I understand not everybody is of what they call a professional quality, but there is nothing more glorious than hearing God's people sing praises to Him. I don't think I have ever heard a person singing that I didn't, when you can tell it's genuine, that doesn't just thrill your soul to know that the Lord's receiving glory from that voice, whether it's of a professional quality or not. We were in a church some time ago that didn't ask you to sing unless you had a professional sound to you. It just always bothered me because the people would stand up there and sing and say, well, yeah, okay, so it's easy on the ears, but it doesn't have that same thrill for me. It's to just hear people singing, to hear God's people lifting up His name in song. Okay. So don't ever hold back your worship because you're afraid of what people will think. And David said, that's exactly what I did. I didn't hold anything back. God got everything I had, every ounce of energy. You really should walk out of Sunday morning worship or Sunday evening worship a little bit tired because you poured it all out for Him. Because He's worthy, isn't He? And so there's David. It was before the Lord, so he deserves it. I gave him everything, and just to remind you, he chose me over your father. So tough noogies. David's response here is pretty stern. He finishes it off at the end of verse 21. I will make merry before the Lord. Verse 22, I will make myself yet more contemptible than this, and I will be abased in your eyes. In other words, you think that's bad. Wait till you see what else I'm going to do in my worship for the Lord. If you're embarrassed by this, then you just better hang on because things are going to get bad. I think I've told you how the Lord rebuked me when I was a young Christian, and I went to work, and at the time I was really wrestling with whether or not I should give thanks in a visible way before I ate. And I knew all the biblical examples are, yes, do so. Just give thanks. And I thought, well, you know, I can give thanks in my head, and God knows that. And there's always something poking at me saying, Brian, do you love me or don't you love me? Are you worried about what people will think? And one time I was at work at the grocery store that I worked at, and it was my lunch break. So I took my lunch upstairs, and I sat down, and I was wrestling with it in my head whether or not, if there was anybody else in the break room, if I should bow my head and give thanks in a visible way. And I walked into the break room, and sure enough, there were like 8 people sitting around the table. It was full. And I said, oh no, I'm going to have to make this decision. So I sat down, and I didn't. I tried to pray quietly just without bowing, and it's like, okay, it's hitting a wall because I know I'm doing wrong here. And so I started to eat, and guy at the end of the table, not a churchgoer by any stretch of the imagination, but he looks at me, and he was joking, but he didn't realize what the Lord was using him to do. He says, Kelly, we pray before we eat here. And I said, okay, Lord, I will. So I bowed my head and prayed. And when I looked up, he was looking at me like, I was just kidding. I said, I know you were kidding, but the Lord wasn't kidding. And Paul says in his epistles, if I were still trying to please man, I could not be a servant of Christ. And as we looked at this morning, if I'm going to love him, I've got to love him above everything else, including myself, including my own reputation and what people think about me. And I've got to choose to put him first. So David is basically saying that, yeah, you think this was embarrassing? Wait till you see what else I'm going to do. David writes for us many of our psalms, and they are ecstatic. They are energetic. There was a lot of good music going on in that temple precinct because of David. Because he was able to pour his heart out, whether he was in agony over a situation or whether he was rejoicing over a situation, he didn't hold back in worship at all. And you've got to love it. Verse 23, Michal has refused a blessing. She could have taken part in this worship right alongside of her husband. She could have followed his lead and been united with him, joined in the worship that he was leading, but she decided not to, and she's going to miss out on a huge blessing. Verse 23, and Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child to the day of her death. Hear the judgment of God upon her, that she gets to bear no children. We're going to find out next week the Davidic covenant. We're going to take a look at the importance of that event. But as that applies to now, the Davidic covenant means David is the man that mirrors what the Messiah will do. What David does in a small way, Christ is going to do in a perfect way. He's the image. He's the antitype. Or sorry, he's the type of what Jesus is going to do. He's a picture of it. Jesus is called the Son of David, because he is literally descended from David in his genealogies. But guess who's not on that list? Michal. Doesn't get to join in that blessing because she refused to worship Jehovah the way that she should. So it's got to instruct us when we're considering our service for the Lord. Don't leave anything. Don't hold back on it. God deserves everything. He's worthy of your every thought. He's worthy of the last bit of your energy that you can expend in singing and in serving. And God doesn't just get worshiped on Sunday mornings. He gets worshiped every moment of your life as you choose to do what He says rather than what someone else says. Don't hold back on it and miss out on that blessing. Any questions about what's going on?